Mr. McGovern.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. My name is Owen McGovern, and along with my co-counsel, Kate Reardon, we're representing appellant John Ford. We're practicing today pursuant to Supreme Court Rule 711 through the Bloom Legal Clinic at Northwestern University School of Law. We ask this Court to reverse John Ford's conviction for two reasons. First, because the District Court erroneously excluded Ford's primary witness, Russ Martin, and second, because it failed to suppress the testimony of the government's key witness, Danny Thomas. Beginning with Russ Martin, the court excluded his testimony under Federal Rule of Criminal Procedure 12.1, which governs the notice of alibi testimony. Simply put, Russ Martin was not an alibi witness. He could not testify to where John Ford was at the time of the crime. Alibi testimony is a defense based upon impossibility, which says I could not have committed the crime because I was somewhere else. Since Russ Martin could not offer this type of testimony, the rule should not have been applied to him, and this is an abuse of discretion.
Well, what was he going to test? What was his role as a defense witness? What would it have been?
His role as a defense witness was to testify that at 7:30 that evening, 2 hours after the crime occurred, not at the time of the crime, that he was with the defendant, and that his demeanor was calm, friendly, and professional, just as it had been every other encounter he had had with him. This relevance is best indicated by the counterexample, which is if the government were to say, we have a witness who says 2 hours after the crime, the defendant was anxious, he was agitated, but he is usually calm and friendly and professional. That would certainly be indicative that he had done something wrong earlier that day.
But the problem is that defense counsel didn't proffer that basis for this witness's testimony at the time. I thought the district court went to some lengths to try to find out what the point of this reference or this witness was, if not as an alibi witness. And the defense counsel at the time didn't actually proffer that basis for his testimony. That came up after the fact.
That's actually not true, Your Honor. If you look at page 382 of the transcript, defense counsel says explicitly that his demeanor by default, would suggest that he had not just been out robbing a bank a few hours earlier. And that is a sufficient basis to sustain the objection as relevant.
What if Martin would have testified that 2 hours after the robbery he had seen Ford in Los Angeles? Would that be an alibi?
Yes, Your Honor, because alibi is a defense based upon impossibility. You could not be in Los Angeles 2 hours after
robbing a bank. But he could be where he saw Martin 2 hours later. So what's the relevance of it?
I'm sorry?
What's the relevance?
Well, the relevance is that his demeanor...
Well, who cares? I don't understand. What does that mean, his demeanor? What do we know about people's demeanor after they commit crimes? They're perfectly calm, right? I got away with it, right? I got away with it. I'm feeling good. What is there some body of studies which shows that you can spot a criminal 2 hours after the crime? His lips are trembling, or he's slavering, or something. What?
Well, no, Your Honor. It's just
a body of thought about that.
Well, it's a common-sense inference.
No, it's not common sense. I don't see the common sense of it. Why should a criminal be nervous after he commits the crime? Maybe nervous during the commission. Afterwards, what? I never heard of this before.
Well, because
the theory that criminals 2 hours later are still trembling over what they've done.
Well, because if it was the opposite inference, if he looked anxious, if he looked agitated, that would be admissible to say that he had just done something wrong, potentially, if this case came up. But a normal person doesn't just rob a bank and is...
No, the notion that... No, that's not right. The notion that if something is evidence of crime, its absence is evidence of innocence. That's not true, right?
Well, no, not as a general, not in every instance, but I think that a jury could conclude that having looked at...
I think it would be irrational to conclude that. You'd have to know a great deal about this person's psychology to know how he's likely to look, how he's likely to behave 2 hours after committing a crime.
Well, Your Honor, the witness did have significant interaction with him over the course of the period. He met with him 10 times during November. And I'm sorry if I could just move on quickly before my rebuttal time meeting into it. Just like to say really very quickly that not suppressing Danny Thomas's testimony in light of the fact that he made another identification the day after the crime severely prejudiced the case because it shows that he was conflating the night of the robbery plus the person he saw the day after the crime when during the suppression hearing, and counsel's not able to bring that out during the suppression hearing in the context that it most mattered. I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time, please.
Okay, well, thank you. And Ms. Rorden, or is she doing the... Or what, I have two of you listed here. You're doing well. Okay, great. Mr. Burgess?
Good morning, and may it please the Court. Brian Burgess on behalf of the United States. The District Court did not abuse its discretion in this case by excluding 11th-hour testimony that was disclosed for the first time on the third day of trial in violation of Federal Rule of Criminal Procedure 12.1. As Judge Sykes noted, the district court in this case was very careful.
The more substantial issue is the lineup, isn't it? That's the more substantial issue.
We'd be happy to talk about the lineup, Your Honor.
I mean, the way this photo lineup looks like, it really is your eyes are drawn to Ford, right? His head is bigger, he's staring strangely at the viewer. I think it's very suggestive.
Well, we think one of the strongest arguments against that is that three other witnesses to the crime viewed the same array. It was administered by the same detective, and they did not make an identification. There were additional procedures used to avoid misidentification in this case. Detective Bice gave clear instructions that you shouldn't assume this individual is in the lineup, that you shouldn't assume that we know who the suspect is. It seems
he looks so different from the others because he's extremely pale, and all the others are swarthy. All the others are dark. The two of them have very red faces. And brown. I mean, they're all white, obviously, but they're all dark. And he's very, very light. So he can't. Don't you have any light, very pale people in your? Must be some huge file of photographs of suspicious characters that you put in these photo lineups, right?
This was from the Palatine Police Department's database of arrest mugshots. With respect, we do think several of these individuals are quite pale and do meet the general description. Certainly the individual in the upper left of the photo would be described as someone that is pale, has very white skin, also has light eyebrows, which are part of the identification.
You look at them together, there's one really pale guy, and everyone else is darker. I won't say they're all dark. They're all darker.
All this court's cases require is that the...
One of them is heavily sunburned. I don't know.
All this court's cases require is that the witnesses fall within a reasonable range of similarity. Clones are...
I think it is a reasonable range. I think they... Is the problem that Palatine is small and they just don't have a big collection of photos of suspicious-looking people? Is that the problem?
There's no indication in the record about the size of the database. The police officer testified that he looked through a range of pictures, attempted to find people that were within the same basic age, race, other characteristics, including skin tone. And with respect, while not all these individuals look the same, we do think the upper left, the upper right, and probably the bottom center are individuals that would be described as rather pale. There, five out of the six individuals have white eyebrows, which was part of the description.
They're all quite dark. The lightest is the lower right-hand side, the fellow with the mustache and beard.
But the district court, and I understand the standard is de novo on the ultimate question of whether this is suggestive, but the district court noted it had seen several of these photo array cases, and this was actually one of the fairest that it had ever seen, that these individuals were within a range of similarity. And again, we think it is highly relevant.
But isn't it much better to show the pictures in sequence? Because if you show a group, then the person is going to feel, well, the guilty person is somewhere in here. And then you find the one who seems to you to look most like the person. Whereas if you're shown in sequence, you don't know what's coming next and so on. So it's not as suggestive.
As we've noted in our brief on page 49 and 50 and in the footnotes, the social science on that question is unsettled. There is some early social science research that suggests that might be the case, that sequential arrays could be superior. There are more recent findings that suggest that finding is not robust. And we don't think that that's a sufficient basis to incorporate into the due process inquiry whether, based on unsettled social science, in a case where the district court found that the judge took effort, or I'm sorry, that the officer did his best to avoid suggestion, we don't think unsettled social science provides a basis to keep this identification away from the jury.
Do their best to. I mean, what they want is a suggestive identification, not so suggestive that it's going to be thrown out, right? They obviously have, they know who they think is guilty. They want the witness to identify that person.
With respect, we have much more faith in the good faith of police officers.
That's so unrealistic, really.
That's not the testimony of the officer.
They know these people, right? They know, they have very good, they're confident they know who's guilty, usually. And they want, and they're helping to build a case. There's nothing wrong with that, but it just means you have to be careful and evaluate. The judges have to be careful in evaluating this evidence.
If that were the officer's intent in this case, there were four witnesses. Only one of the four actually made an identification. Three of the other witnesses indicated that, in fact, they could not make an identification and did not do so.
What was the lapse in time between the crime and the...
It was approximately 16 months.
16 months.
That's correct.
Have passed.
Right. Which,
okay, and they've got a DNA hit on this defendant.
That's correct.
Because he was wearing a mask. The mask
that's correct,
was recovered.
Near the scene of the crime, yes, that's correct.
And had his DNA, which may go to harmlessness later. But so they arrest him based on the DNA hit and then put together this photo array?
The array was put together before the actual arrest, but the array was put together on the basis of the DNA hit, and that's why John Ford's photo was used in the array. That's correct.
Was there any thought given to a lineup?
As I noted, he was not in custody at this point.
But the DNA gave the police probable cause to arrest him, right?
That I think that's probably correct, but I think it's reasonable for the police to want to develop their case further before they would actually have to go through the step of making an arrest. There's no indication in this case that there was another photograph available of John Ford other than the one that was taken from the Michigan Department of Corrections website. The officer then did his best to make that photo look as similar as possible to the other pictures. That's his testimony, that he put them through a scanner and adjusted.
So is that why it took? Why there was this 16-month interval that they were looking for a picture of him?
No, the 16-month interval was as a result of the forensic evidence. It took approximately a year at the state laboratory because they do have a backlog. Yeah.
Now, I was surprised you didn't argue harmless error given the DNA. Identification.
We think there is a reasonable case that can be made for harmless error, and obviously
why didn't you argue it?
The reason we didn't argue it is because reviewing the trial transcript, it does seem that the eyewitness identification was a substantial part of the case. We think there's a reasonable argument that can be made. It's nonetheless harmless, but given the beyond a reasonable doubt standard for given that it's a due process issue, we haven't made harmlessness argument with respect to that. We did, of course, make it with respect to the exclusion of the alibi testimony, that even if this court believes it shouldn't have been excluded, that error would be clearly harmless.
That's fine. Great. Okay.
I only spoke briefly about the alibi testimony. If the court has any additional questions, I'd be happy to entertain them. Otherwise, we'll rest on our brief.
Okay. Okay, well,
I just have one quick follow-up question. Was there any thought to, in presenting the survey to the witnesses about covering up, since the robber was wearing a mask, to covering up the lower half of the face that would strengthen the ID?
That was an argument that was made to the jury by defense counsel. We think that's a quite reasonable jury argument, but the claim was that this individual was able to see a substantial part. He wasn't able to see the mouth or the nose, but he saw his neck. He was able to get a good view of skin color, and the detective's testimony was that a limited array like that would not have involved the full descriptive features given by the witness.
There were some surveillance photos in the bank.
That's correct, yes.
That the jurors had.
Those were entered into the record. The district court also reviewed them during the suppression hearing, and it was part of the basis for concluding that this witness did get a very good view of John Ford, that he was, or of the robber, who we believe is John Ford, that he was able to see this person from eyeball to eyeball distance, and that helped inform that finding, which is why we think the identification is clearly reliable, even if the court found, as we don't think is appropriate, that there was undue suggestion in the array. There are no further questions. We ask this court to affirm the conviction.
Thank you very much, Mr. Burgess. Ms. Rorden?
May it please the court, I'd like to make just two points about the suggestiveness of the array and the ultimate unreliability of Thomas's testimony. Firstly, the government's contention that the array couldn't have been suggested because Thomas was the only person to identify the defendant out of the array can't be true because none of the other witnesses saw anything of the crime altogether. All they could identify was a white man, and that's it. Thomas was the only individual who was able to identify even sparse identifying characteristics of the robber, and all he could really identify over and over again was this pale and freckled skin. He cited to it no less than 6 times during the suppression hearing, and when the witness can only identify one or two characteristics that are salient in terms of the offender, when the photo array contains only one person who possesses those characteristics, it's unduly suggestive. Now, even though the government waived harmless error, the harm is clear in this case because after this suggestive photo array in which the detective had informed Thomas that there was DNA evidence in the case, which allowed Thomas to now become 100% certain, 16 months after the crime, that he had identified the correct individual, Thomas created an amalgam of 2 different individuals in his mind. There was the identification of the robber and the sparse characteristics of being pale and freckled, and then the next day, he identified another individual, John Filer.
I think that has the force that you assigned to it. He's probably the next day, he's probably nervous, and sees anyone who looks a little like the robber. He thinks, maybe this guy's coming back. And I don't think that was so surprising or significant. There's no real doubt about his guilt, actually.
We believe that there is, Your Honor.
What about the DNA evidence?
The DNA was not dispositive. Firstly, this was not a paternity test. This was trace DNA that had to be amplified many times. The DNA was highly contested throughout the course of the trial, and there were many alleles that did not match, and it ended up being quite a subjective process about which alleles were determined to be inconclusive versus not matching. If the DNA had been conclusive, the jury wouldn't
challenge any of that in your appeal.
No, we did not challenge. However, I think the fact that the jury asked for additional photos of Ford in their 3-hour deliberation shows that the DNA wasn't dispositive to the jury. If the DNA was, they wouldn't have asked for additional photos of the defendant.
The jury asked for additional photos?
Yes.
Of the defendant?
They did, Your Honor, during their deliberations. That was refused.
Were there additional photos in evidence?
No, there weren't. But they,
why did they want additional photos? They had seen them in the courtroom. What was?
Perhaps they also had questions about the array, the surveillance photos. As Judge Tinder pointed out, you couldn't really see anything because of the hat and the mask. So perhaps they wanted, it's pure speculation at this point.
So they might, with the photos, compare it to the video?
Perhaps.
The surveillance photos and see whether there was a closer
match.
Perhaps,
but that's pure speculation on my part.
So the jury was just asking for random photos of the defendant, nothing that was in evidence, or?
Not that we could tell.
How long did they deliberate?
3 hours, Your Honor. So because of this Theiler report, the problem with it is not just that Thomas was, you know, quote-unquote, doing his job by saying this guy looked like him. He said he was nearly identical. And then he was using facts from that report in the suppression hearing. Meanwhile, he claimed that he didn't remember the fact of Theiler himself, so that during suppression that never came up and the judge couldn't consider it. And when
Does the record have a picture of this person he reported the day after the robbery?
There was a picture that was published to the jury.
Does he look like Ford?
He has darker hair and darker skin. And again, the problem with this photo array is, as you correctly pointed out, Your Honor, is that the skin is incredibly washed out, and it just jumps out at you, and the contrast seems to have been compromised at some point so that it looks like he has a lot of freckles. And again, when you're only looking for pale and freckles, that's the person you're obviously going to choose.
The motion to suppress the ID was renewed prior to trial after the defense got the evidence about the next day.
The file report. Yes, Your Honor.
And the judge overruled or denied the motion.
Yes, the judge actually refused to reconsider. He said on the record, I don't know if you're asking me to reconsider, but I'm not going to. Which, you know, caused an incredible amount of harm to our defendant's case. This was the only person who identified him, and now at this point he claims to be 100% certain of the fact. But in the meantime, he's created this, you know, composite picture where he says, you know, oh, he was wearing boots. No, he was wearing gym shoes. And then saying, well, I knew he was wearing gym shoes because the day after I knew he was wearing gym shoes. He was cherry-picking facts. And he wasn't just remembering the robber. He was remembering the robber plus whatever he saw the next day. He had created this amalgam in his mind. So even though the district judge thought that this could be cured on cross-examination, it simply couldn't be because there was nothing to pin him down to. And Thomas was allowed to be as slippery as he wanted. If there are no further questions, we ask that you reverse remand. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Rorden and Mr. McGovern and Mr. Burgess as well. And thank you to Northwestern for your vigorous efforts on behalf of your client. So.